After an excellent and sustaining breakfast, Ryan had a last brief meeting with Nicholas Brody.
Come in.
The big bearded man was alone in his study, doubled over his desk. He had a white handkerchief pressed to his face, and Ryan thought that he glimpsed a dappling of crimson before the headmaster quickly put it back into his pocket.
Are you all right? Should I get someone?
No, no. No, my dear fellow. Something I ate must have slipped down the wrong way. Foolish of me. Do forgive me for that histrionic impersonation of the Lady of Camellias. A fine book, my dear Mr. Carter. Perhaps we can introduce it to the boy. He seems to have settled in wonderfully. His dormitory prefect said he slept well and was no trouble at all. Excellent.
I just wanted to look in before I left, to make sure everything was all right about Dean.
Better than all right, I think, Mr. Carter. The lad is obviously bright. We have been observing him. He's the most self-sufficient 11-year-old I think I've ever known in my long career as a pedagogue.
Not many 11-year-olds have lived like Dean has. Not many chilled as many people as he has.
Chilled as many? Oh, I see. It is a joke, Mr. Carter. Slightly ghoulish, and not perhaps in the very best taste, but none the worse for that.
Ryan realized he shouldn't have mentioned that fact, but it seemed like he was going to get away with it.
One thing, Mr. Brody.
Yes. If it's the teaching of intrapersonal relationships and human hygiene, I think you can rest assured that we handle this with great sensitivity and concern.
Not that. I'm heading for Leadville, then on across the tops to the next valley along, up to the head of that to Fairplay. One of my friends comes from Harmony, near there. But I heard stories of trouble.
I fear so. We, too, have heard such tales, which is why our highway was being patrolled with more than usual zeal.
Any details?
How long since your companion was in Harmony? Does he visit often?
She.
I'm sorry?
She hasn't been back for many years. Her mother lived there, but she's lost touch.
Alas and alack that this happens so frequently in Deathlands.
What kind of trouble was it?
Ah, yes. We heard of a gang of bounty hunters and general bandits. The odd part of the tale was that there were gnomes and muties riding together.
We ran into three killers on the road here from Glenwood Springs. They'd slaughtered an old man with a mule and a girl.
And did the perpetrators of this evil act sleep last night in the bosom of Abraham?
You mean, did we chill them?
I do, indeed.
We did, indeed.
They might have been a rotten branch off that same corrupt tree, Mr. Carter. Take the greatest of care. We would not want our newest pupil to suddenly become an orphan.
Yes. Thanks.
Brody stood and walked to Ryan. The two men shook hands.
Safe passage, Mr. Carter.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Ryan walked alone down the corridor to where Dean waited for him. The boy was looking out a window across the lake. He turned and grinned at his father.
Hot pipe, Dad!
What is?
You've saved me from doing English grammar with old Coco Copeland. The boys reckon he's a real bastard.
Watch the language, Dean. Please.
Sorry. Anyway, you've got to go now, haven't you, Dad? Give my love to all the others.
Dean was being unnaturally bright and perky, but there was a forced smile pasted uneasily on his face.
Now do that. Remember, if there's serious trouble, a message will eventually find me and we'll all come running.
Sure, sure. Thanks, Dad. But from what I've seen so far, I don't mind it too bad.
Ryan put a hand on the boy's shoulder.
It's all right, son. It's all right.
It took several moments for them both to recover some control over their emotions. They each wiped their eyes.
Sorry about that, Dad. I promised myself I wasn't going to break down.
Yeah, me too, son. Me too. All right. I'm going now.
Then I'll go and do grammar. Then Christy won't have to gripe at me again.
Ryan turned away quickly and opened the door into the passage. Ryan knew that Dean had led a hand-to-mouth existence with his mother, Sharona, for several years. He'd faced a lot of adversity in his short life, and now he had a chance to settle down to a regular life for a year or so in relative peace and quiet. He'd gain some education and acquire some life skills. Ryan couldn't deny his son that, though it tore at his heart to leave him behind.
In a year, son, if not sooner.
Ahab and Joel were both waiting for Ryan outside. They escorted him for a couple of miles along the road, away from the school. It was a fine morning, with a few bunched clouds to the northwest that held the possible threat of a storm later in the day. They recognized that Ryan wasn't in a talking mood, and the three of them walked along in silence. At the crest of a rise in the trail, Ryan turned and took one last long look at the buildings. He thought that he might have glimpsed a little figure waving something white from a second-story window, but he couldn't be sure.
We'll leave you here, Outlander. Get back to our patrolling.
Thanks. I guess I feel all right about leaving my son in the school. Seemed like nice kids and teachers. And Brody himself. Real bad coffee, Scott, though. The sec men exchanged glances.
Worries us as well. Head was supposed to be seeing some top doctor back east, Kansas City way. But he never went. Some days he seems fine, but on cold, wet days it can grip him.
Brody told me a bit about a gang of norms and muties.
Yeah, we heard they were picking on some of the frontier pest holes and taking them over. Suck them dry and move on, like fucking locusts they are.
Yeah, they'll think twice about coming our way. You need sharp teeth to bite us off.
You know a ville called Harmony?
That up Nebraska way?
No, that's a place beyond the divide, couple of valleys over east. You know that swank old ski place, Breckenridge?
Oh, yeah. Head of the valley there, isn't it? Beyond, what do you call it?
Fair play.
Right. On the money, stranger. Fair play. Harmony's beyond that. Is that the ville you're heading for?
Yeah. Meeting friends there.
Joel patted the Steyr rifle on Ryan's back.
You'll need that and some more like it if that gang sees you.
Thanks for the warning.
After shaking hands with the two men, Ryan turned eastward and began the long, lonely walk back onto the main trail. Mildred was the last of the companions to enjoy the deep tub, brimming with hot water. Each successive bath seemed to take longer for the water to heat properly, and Christy was beginning to get edgy at the delay. JB had been reading through a pile of magazines from the pre-dark days, and he picked up another Reader's Digest.
Ryan will likely spend little time at this school before he leaves Dean there. We know they were both safely through that ambush, and we got a place fixed for a rendezvous. You'll be fine, Christy, you'll see.
Worry not, dear madam. The bullet has not been cast, nor the blade forged that bears the name of Ryan Corder. Another couple of days, and we shall all be reunited once more.
Christy was reassured by that. All of them had noticed that the electricity had begun to fail. Several lights had gone out, though replacement bulbs from a bag in the garage had kept some going. The microwave oven and stove had both ceased to work. Christy walked to the bottom of the stairs and looked up.
Come on, Mildred. It'll be dark before we get going. In fact, it's getting dark already.
Only a little after two. But it does seem gloomy.
I'll take a look.
Jack put down a book on handguns and went to the front door. He stood there for several seconds, taking in the weather.
Big storm underway.
Snow?
Probably. Sky like lead. Wind's rising. Whole mess coming this way.
Everyone except Mildred, who was still relaxing in the tub, rushed out to look. Jack's description had been accurate. The sky was dark, slate gray, with heavy clouds squatting over the mountaintops a few miles away.
Moving this way.
Maybe if we get out now, we can outflank it. Looks from its path like it might not reach farther up the trail.
I do most earnestly comprehend your reasoning, my dearest Christy. To be reunited with Ryan is the wish of all of us. But that storm, to be exposed on the hillside in the teeth of that...
When we can sit it out in warmth and comfort and safety. Seems like close to suicide to run against that. It's gonna be a real triple big blow, Christy. Real big.
We have to try and get going. Please. I'm getting more and more worried about what's happening to Ryan.
Ryan was 15 or 20 miles east of them, striding steadily toward the township of Leadville. He'd seen no further signs of human life, though the forest seemed to teem with activity. A pack of 30 or 40 gaunt coyotes had snarled at him until he had unslung the rifle and shot the leader, sending the rest of the animals scattering. He had also seen a moose, and once a black bear lumbered quickly across the highway, about 80 yards ahead of him. And there were enough deer to keep a man going for years. At a sharp turn in the road, he looked back and down, wondering how far the others were behind him, or whether they might have passed by while he was at Brody's school and be ahead of him. Staring behind, Ryan was able to see the huge storm that looked as if it would cut the trail about 10 miles below him. silver lace of lightning broke around the tops of the clouds. He could see at the base that it was either snow or unimaginably heavy rain.
Hope they're free of that.
Supplied with trail food by the kitchens of the Brody School, Ryan made good time. He reached the edge of Leadville well before dusk, passing the rusted remains of what had obviously been an old pre-dark railroad. A battered sign told when he passed the 10,000-foot altitude line, though his body had already warned him that he was approaching the edge of the comfort zone. When he stopped, he was aware of the blood pounding in his ears. The ghost of a headache pressed behind his eye, and he felt slightly nauseous. He knelt along the side of the crystal-clear stream and cupped his hands. After a drink of water, he felt refreshed and carried on toward the Ville. He knew from his memory of the map he'd seen in Glenwood Springs that Leadville was only about 25 miles from Fairplay, as the crow flies. Unfortunately, only a crow could make it in that distance. For humans, there was the little matter of 15,000-foot mountains in the way. The only viable route involved heading back north from the Ville to Fremont Pass at 11,500 feet, then trying to cut across to the Hoosier Pass above Breckenridge at a similar height. To stick to the main highways would mean going all the way back to I-70, then heading south once more, which would be a total distance of more than 60 miles. When he reached the fork in the road, Ryan hesitated. Part of him wanted to get on as fast as he could to reach Fairplay and meet up with Christy and the others, who he imagined might well be ahead of him by now. Evening was closing in, and the attractions of Leadville overrode his impatience. The chance of a night spent in a warm bed and some good hot food was altogether too tempting for him to resist. He turned right toward the distant buildings of the Ville, a place that he knew well from his visit with Trader. Back in the 1800s, it had been a gold boomtown, then a silver boomtown. Its fortunes had been linked to the larger-than-life millionaire philanderer Horace Tabor, but had declined by the middle of the 20th century, when it had lurched from mini-bus to mini-boom and back again. When Ryan had visited the place with Trader and the lumbering war wags, it had been a bustling frontier pest hole with several gaudies and saloons, one of them established in what had been Leadville's very own opera house. He recalled that Doc had mentioned that a famous writer called Oscar Wilde had once traveled all the way to Leadville to perform there. Now Ryan was back once more, this time on foot and alone, knowing that in pest holes like that, an outlander had to set his feet real careful and watch his back. He pulled a tangy apple out of his pocket and set to walk the last mile or so into Leadville. A little after midnight, Christy stood by the picture window of the isolated house, gazing out at the moonlit, snow-smeared land.
You were right, J.B. Must be 4 or 5 feet out there. Came down like out the back of a dump truck.
Trader used to say that the more you wanted something, the more your judgment and common sense flew out the door.
For once, the old son of a bitch was probably right.
Often was.
Doc had gone to bed, deciding an hour or so earlier that they weren't going anywhere for a while. Mildred dozed on the sofa while Jack idly juggled three of his knives. He sent them high toward the ceiling in a weaving maze of honed steel. He had yet to drop one. They'd enjoyed a nutritious supper of freeze-dried mulligatawny soup and some more of the self-baked rolls, but Mildred had gone carefully through the entire larder and found very little else that she considered safe for them to eat. Also, the hot water system had packed up both for washing and for heating, which meant the house, despite its excellent insulation, was already beginning to drop in temperature, apart from the living room where they were keeping the fire going. Jack had struggled out before the snow had settled in deep drifts and brought in several loads of wood, enough to ensure warmth for at least 24 hours.
When do you reckon we can move on, J.B.? Any chance of tomorrow?
Doubt it. You never know. Weather can change in a few hours, but that's serious snow and nobody's going to be out there cleaning the trail for us.
You worried about Ryan?
Of course I am. What do you think? Sorry. I'm on edge. If only we knew where he was. He could be safe in the school. They could both be trapped out in the open, stuck in a snow hole with no food.
Could be the storm missed him. Looked like he was on the north edge of it.
Shh. Anyone hear that?
Wolves.
You can hear them too?
Of course. Heard him a few minutes ago. Came closer, went away. Coming closer again.
Jack crossed to the wide picture window in the living room. He peered outside. Muti wolves. There were more than a dozen of them outside, rangy animals, the biggest of them standing at least 4 feet high at the shoulder. They had stopped howling and were now unnervingly silent, contenting themselves with sitting in a half circle and observing the humans observing them. Their shadows were crisp and clean in the bright moon.
The brutes look half-starved to me, gaunt and hungered. So much for a good night's rest.
I agree with that, Doc. Looks like they regard us as being their next meal.
A choice selection of cold cuts, personally selected by our chef for your dining pleasure. Look at the way their leader has his tongue hanging out. And those astounding fangs. Ah, yes, I remember them well. Fangs for the memory. Yeah, sorry.
Problem is how long they're prepared to stay out there.
I don't think I'll be going out to bring in more logs.
Chill them all from upstairs. Easy target for you, Mildred.
Not yet, anyways. Rat-blasted animals would run at first or second death. Noise could bring more of them. Riding with Trader in northern Minnesota, we once counted a pack of nearly 200 wolves all running together. If that number turns up here, then we are in serious trouble.
It was a chilling thought, and stopped any more conversation dead in its tracks. A vacant-faced lad was working on a 5-bar gate as Ryan passed the first few houses of Leadville. Ryan walked over to him.
Hey, is there a good place to stay the night in the Ville?
The teenager turned and gave him a moonish smile.
Why, sure, mister, I know that all right. Palace Hotel, S-U-N's bus palace, don't it?
Likely it does, son.
Around the corner and down the hill and on your right.
Much obliged.
Around the corner and down the hill brought him into the Ville's main drag. The sun had almost set, and lights were on in many of the buildings. A number of saloons and gaudies were open for business. The palace rooming house was where the boy had said it would be. Across the street was an eatery called Carl and Joanna's Diner. Ryan figured he'd stop in for a bite before he checked into his room. A middle-aged man with an apron tied over his ample stomach appeared, offering him a handwritten menu.
You got the reading, stranger? Or one of the girls can tell you what we got on tonight.
I read, thanks.
Table for yourself, or do you mind sharing?
I prefer my own company.
The man put a finger to his lips.
Nod's as good as a wink to a blind man, friend. This way.
He pushed between the tables, and Ryan followed.
Passing through?
Yeah. Come up from Glenwood Springs. Meeting some people in a few days.
All right. Well, my name's Carl, and you can have a seat here, and I'll be back to hear your order real soon.
Ryan sat down at the table in the back of the diner and looked over the menu. The menu offered would sounded like real good cooking. There was duck with a sauce made from oranges, turkey stuffed with cinnamon apples, breast of goose with mushrooms, steaks of all shapes and sizes, with a range of about 8 different vegetables.
You ready?
Yeah. I'll have the duck with sweet corn and cream potatoes, with butter and mashed carrots and snow peas. Oh, and lemonade with the food.
No problem.
Carl disappeared again with Ryan's order. The place was 3 parts full. There were several locals, probably storekeepers and folks working in offices, as well as a scattering of miners and trappers. Carl was rushing around, busier than a 1-legged man in an avalanche. The thin-faced woman with glasses visible in the kitchen had to be Joanna. She caught Ryan looking at her and gave him a distracted smile and a half wave of the hand. Soon, Carl was hustling over to Ryan's table with a big tray full with food.
That everything, mister?
I think so.
Enjoy your meal.
Everything was delicious, cooked to perfection. Ryan caught Joanna's eye again and gave her a double thumbs up, getting a broad smile in return. Ryan was 3 parts through his dinner when he felt the coldness of steel against the back of his neck.
One move and your face ends up blown into your plate, stranger. We want to talk to you about what happened to some friends down the Glenwood Trail.
Everyone in the house had finally gone to bed, leaving the fire piled high with enough wood to last most of the night. Christy lay on the sofa beneath a couple of blankets. Most of the bedding had gone to the upstairs sleepers, where the cold was beginning to bite. She had lain awake for some time, plagued with worry that something had gone wrong for Ryan and Dean. she finally slipped into an uneasy sleep. There was nothing to see when Christy looked around, the bright flames dancing off the reflecting glass. Jack was still asleep across the room from her, his white hair tinted pink by the fire. Jack was awake now.
What was that?
Christy was up on her feet, walking toward the window.
Something knocking against... Oh, Gaia!
It was the wolves. One of them was just moving away, limping a little. And now the pack leader was coming at a rush. He charged through the snow, jaws wide, eyes flaring, straight for the glass. The beast weighed at least 300 pounds, and Christy knew instantly that the window wasn't going to stop it. A mirror on the wall opposite Ryan enabled him to see the three men behind him. He cursed his lack of caution, lulled by the excellent food. The one holding the short-barreled revolver at the base of Ryan's skull was average height. His face was lean, with oddly thick lips. A deep scar seamed his left cheek. He looked to be around 30, and his two companions were both much younger.
You come from Glenwood, mister?
Ryan took a mouthful of food and glanced up, trying to make a combat judgment of the trio. Neither of the younger men had weapons drawn, though they were wearing revolvers and holsters. They were obviously content that their older companion had the situation well under control.
Glenwood. Yeah.
When?
3-4 days back.
How come it took so long? Was you on foot?
Yeah. I was with my young son. Taking him up to the school over yonder.
Brody's place?
That's the one.
You see anything of some good friends of ours? Some good, good friends?
They got names?
Joey and a couple of kids. Wait. What was their names?
Eddie and Manuel.
Right. They went off to try to get some supplies and stuff. And they don't come back.
Well, judging from the sky, it looked like there was plenty of snow behind me. Could be they got caught in that.
That might be right, Gordy.
I don't know. Looks like this outlander's the only person to come up in the last week. Well, there was that old man and the girl going down with their burro.
But we know they weren't going to make it to the springs, don't we, Harv?
The teenager Harv showed a strange dental arrangement where every other black and rotting tooth was capped with gold, reminding Ryan of a piano keyboard.
They should have been back by now.
Gordy pressed the muzzle of his gun harder against the back of Ryan's head.
And this son of a bitch is gonna tell us about it.
Carl spotted the disturbance and bustled over, wiping his hands on his apron.
What's going on here?
Butt out, asshole. Got us some business with the outlander here.
It's all right, Carl. Let it lie, or you'll likely get yourself hurt.
I can help.
No, you run a great eatery, but I don't see you as a shootist. Let it lie. Best all around to do that.
Don't want to make a mess, huh? Especially inside your pants. Then let's go outside and talk this over.
Right.
Ryan had let his shoulders slump, knowing the importance of body language, allowing the three killers to think they had him cowed and totally at their mercy. He started to stand, pushing himself up with his right hand so they could see he wasn't doing anything foolish, such as reaching for his Sig Sauer. The muzzle of the gun moved from his nape, and he was able to see what it was. A Lama Comanche Model 2 with a 4-inch barrel, chambered to take a big 38 caliber round. It was enough gun to spread Ryan's skull all over the mirror.
Watch the rest of the crowd in case there's any folks want to turn into a dead hero.
The two teenagers turned away so that Ryan could see only their backs. They dropped hands to holsters in a parody of a menacing gunslinger. Gordy had also turned away for a moment, checking out the other tables. Ryan had kept hold of the three-pronged fork that he'd used to finish off the delicious dinner. He seized the moment. He swung to his right, slapping the llama away from him with his free hand and lunging with the fork at Gordy's astonished face. His target had been the right eye, but the man had reacted more quickly than Ryan had expected. But the fork had still caught him, gouging a deep wound beneath his right eye, burying itself in the side of his nose near the top. Blood gushed down over his mouth onto the floor. Ryan left the fork where it was. The two teenagers turned around. Before what had happened even registered, Ryan pushed them both off balance. Ryan was totally oblivious to the diner's panic, his mind focusing coldly on what he had to do. Gordy had his gun out as well. Gordy went down, shot in the chest, the fork still wobbling grotesquely from his nose. Ryan concentrated now on taking out the two teenagers. Neither of them had yet managed to draw his weapon. Carl was moving in behind one of them, reaching out to grab at the boy.
No! Leave him and get down!
The remaining youth had just recovered his balance. His right hand snatched desperately at the butt of his pistol. His gaze was fixed on Ryan's face. He saw his own death there. All three men lay dead on the restaurant floor.
You took them all?
Had to. They were gonna take me.
Sure. We all saw that. I tried to help.
I know you did, and I truly appreciate it. I'm just sorry for all the mess in here.
Don't worry. We'll get it cleaned up, and folks will come packing in once word gets around.
Best settle my check.
Oh, don't mention it, brother. This one's on the house.